Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me is...
the underqualified but overly charismatic co-host, Jason Bartsch. And we have a pretty exciting episode today, John, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
We say that a lot to middling results, but we mean it this time.
My sister was on last week, and this is what you're saying? Anyway, we have an awesome guest today, the screenwriter of such films as Cobweb, Video Nasty, and the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Chris Devlin, everyone.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So, a little context. Chris, John, and I all went to Temple and all graduated the same year, and we're all in the same film program.
That is true.
So... and in addition to that, Chris and I were actually roommates for about 4 months in LA post-graduation. We went there for their study away program and did some internships out there. And Chris ended up staying out there for a little while after, right?
Mm-hmm. For about 7 years. But first, I'm not going to let you skip over the fact that we lived at the Oakwood Apartments. Okay. And I hope I'm not going off script too immediately. But if you haven't seen it, there is a film called The Hollywood Complex, and that is a documentary about the every pilot season, the Oakwood Apartments is flooded with child actors and their parents trying to make it big. And this documentary is, it was on Amazon Prime. I don't think it's free anymore, but I highly recommend it because it is harrowing. It is, really? It is... the act of killing level disturbing.
Wow.
When you see what goes into this. And I am a person who a lot of the movies I write tend to star children. And trust me, after seeing this movie, I have like Ebenezer Scrooge seeing the error of my ways, and I am not doing that anymore. Yeah, it's fucked.
Yeah, I do. I remember we had a couple child actors living there when we were there. We had the one kid from Super 8. I was like in the hot tub at one point when he he had like an entourage and just like came and sat. And it was like, I think we all saw the movie together. And it was like a day or two after that, he was hanging out there.
Yeah, that sounds accurate. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, it's a place that a lot of people end up sometimes forever. Both Rick James and Corey Haim did die on the premises. But yeah, pilot season specifically is when it becomes the child actor haven.
So yeah, the Oakwood, it was a fun little kind of apartment complex right across from Warner Brothers Studios, actually. Mm-hmm. Down the street from the, I guess, current, now closed Dimples, the karaoke bar.
Once featured on Bar Rescue.
Yeah, probably justifiably so.
Yeah, I was there on the last night.
Were you?
Yeah, it was very bittersweet.
How was occasion. It? Did you get on stage?
No, it was so packed.
Impossible,
It was already tough to get on that stage. But
so Dimples, just to explain it, it's a karaoke bar, but they have a ton of props. And every time you go up on stage, you actually get a DVD of your performance, right? I guess they still did that until they closed. I'm not sure.
But, yeah.
And photos, you know, and everything.
We moved recently from our one apartment to another. Somehow these Dimples DVDs have made the transition every single time.
Nice. Yeah. I came across a few photos when we were moving as well. I'll have to see if I can find them. John, maybe we can put it up on the Instagram.
Oh, that'd be funny. Yeah, that'd be cool.
So anyway, yes, to answer your question. So we both did the internship program. And then my future wife, Chloe, she came out. She had done the internship the year prior. And so she came out while we were there. And so she got an apartment. And then after the program ended, I just moved in with her. And our other friend, Valerie Armstrong, who had done the program the year prior, and now she has a show on AMC called Kevin Can Fuck Himself.
Yes,
going to be premiering that this year.
When? What's the update on that? Is that coming out soon?
I think it's coming out this summer. That's all I can.
That's awesome. Good for her.
Say. I did see, like, I saw the trailer like independently of knowing that you two knew her. I was like, oh, this looks really cool, and I was like going to send the link to Jason on my own, and then I saw your tweet about that you knew her, and I was like. Then I mentioned it to Jason, and he was like, oh, yeah, I know her. I was like, okay, a bunch of big times over here.
As I love pointing out to people, she sent me the pilot years ago and I read it and it was just like, this is really good. I don't think this is a TV show. This is definitely a movie. You should do this as a movie. And so I remind myself of that often when I need a good humbling. I am often wrong.
If this story was me, it would have been, I meant to read it. And now I don't speak to that person anymore because I felt bad for not reading it. All right. So let's move on to what we've been watching. Jason, what have you been watching recently?
So I know last episode I brought up The Wire and how I'm like 15 years late on that. I finished season 3 for anyone who tunes in just to hear the updates of where I'm at on The Wire. So I'll get that out of the way. But in addition to that, I just started watching a show that was recently added to HBO Max. It was originally on Cinemax called Banshee. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but
I've heard good things.
It's kind of like a neo-Western, and it's the premise is this guy gets out of prison. He was in prison for 15 years for stealing diamonds, and then he immediately goes to find his former girlfriend and partner in crime, who is now hiding away in a small town. And his first day in town, he ends up conning his way into being the sheriff. And the whole show is as over the top and as far-fetched as that premise sounds. So I think it works. It's really pulpy and gritty. And I just finished the first season. I mean, it's kind of an easy watch. It's, you know, not something you really need to pay super close attention to, but I don't know. Fun show, Banshee.
Well, I can chime in. And the star of Banshee is this actor, Anthony Starr, who is one of the leads of My Movie Cobweb.
I did see that. That's very exciting.
He's a very talented man. Have you met him yet? Yes. I was on set. I was in Bulgaria for about 4 weeks in October. And
that's awesome.
He's a good guy. Very talented.
He fits the role in Banshee perfectly. The reason I started watching it, one of the creators was an author I'd read a couple books from, Jonathan Tropper. And the show is nothing like the books I read, but I'm, you know, still into it. But yeah, that's awesome. I realized that connection as well, that he's in Cobweb, and that's really exciting.
Yeah. And Homelander on The Boys, which is big.
Yeah, that's what he's
star-making turn.
Yeah, most known for at this point. Was he in The Boys when he was cast for your film?
Yes.
He was. Okay.
Yeah.
And The Boys kind of took off, like, I heard about it a lot more season 2 than season 1. Is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was actually airing while we were in Bulgaria. So So I was like binging it while also simultaneously seeing him IRL.
That's very cool. So John, what have you been watching?
All right. So I watched a movie called Saint Maud, which is it's an A24 film that was meant to come out like 3 times last year. And each time it was really sad for me because I was like really excited to watch it. And apparently the way to watch it now is on Epix now, which is like, I guess they wanted to want people to subscribe to their thing. So
what is Epix exactly?
They have some like Forrest Whitaker show on there. And I don't know what else, just other stuff that's on other platforms.
So it's just like another thing. I got, how many things are we going to have to get like when all is said and done? Is it like somebody's got to come in and just combine them all, right? Or
yeah, you're gonna get a cable package subscription services.
It's just gonna come full circle back to cable at this point. Mm-hmm. Like I'm not buying 9 things a month.
We're gonna be like, no, we had it right. TV comes on, it comes on at a certain time, episodes released once a week,
and you just gotta make yourself available.
Yeah, exactly.
So Saint Maud, so the movie is about a nurse who's caring for a dancer / choreographer who she's dying of cancer, and Maud is a recent convert to Catholicism, and she decides, you know, I'm gonna save her soul. And the movie kind of has like a Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver-esque like descent into madness. And you know, I just found it to be like really interesting to see kind of a, you know, usually like the Travis Bickle kind of story is like very masculine kind of perspective, and this one's from a feminine perspective. And you know, I thought the movie was like really effective for being such a small low budget film. And I don't really want to say much more, but if you haven't seen it, you can get Epics for like $1 for a week or something weird, and you can check that out. So you know, I'd recommend that, or wait till it's on video, you know, whatever. Chris, what have you been watching?
So I've been kind of busy lately, which means that mostly I just go back to Chloe and I are rewatching both Seinfeld and The Sopranos.
Hell yeah.
But I did just watch a movie for the first time that has really stuck with me. And that is Earth Girls Are Easy, which is definitely a movie that I saw a glimpse of when I was younger and a more going through a really turbulent time pubescently. And I was very disappointed by what I saw, given the title. But I was so wrong, because this movie is incredible. It's the third time Gina Davis and Jeff Goldblum have worked together. And somehow it's like the culmination. It came out after The Fly, which, by the way, quick tangent here. I don't know if you've ever been called out for this, but John, in an early episode, you said The Fly, David Cronenberg's The Fly, came out in 1982, when I'm sorry, sir, but that was 1986.
I said 82?
You said 82. John, very confidently.
John, oh my God. I don't even double check your dates, because you're mostly right. Like, if I'm going to have to start double checking your dates.
And I had to stop myself and rewind.
Because I thought it came out the same year as The Thing,
of
right?
Of course. Well, the big summer of 82. Yes, it's a totally understandable mistake to make, but I would be remiss if I didn't come on here and point it out to you.
We're going to need to have an entire, like, corrections and apology episode at this point.
So, anyway, Earth Girls Are Easy is, I'm going to try to be quick about it. It's Gina Davis plays a Southern California hairstylist oh my God, what's it called when you get your nails done? I'm completely blanking on the word. You know what I mean. and she, three aliens wind up in her pool, played by Jeff Goldblum, Jim Carrey, and Damon Wayans.
Wow.
It is basically like when sororities have like 80s theme parties, like this is the vibe and aesthetic that they're going for. It is the most like 80s movie I've ever seen. It's a musical. It's all mostly original music by this woman, Julia Brown, who is also in the movie. It's madness. It was so much fun. Yeah, it's like it scratches an itch that you didn't know you had. So you watched it. I kind of wanted to come here with a horror movie that I'd watched recently that really blew me away, but no, it had to be Earth Girls Are Easy. I'm still talking about it. I'm still thinking about it. Obviously, I'm still talking about it.
That's awesome. Wow. I've never heard of it before, so I'll have to check that out.
It's on HBO Max. Do yourself a favor.
Gonna have to watch that.
Well, okay. So let's get into our review of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And Jason, could you tell us the plot summary, please?
Upon learning that their grandfather's grave may have been vandalized, Sally and her wheelchair-bound brother Franklin travel with a group of friends to investigate. While there, they decide to visit their family's old homestead, only to discover the next-door neighbors are a family of murderous backwoods butchers out for blood. One by one, the group is targeted by a chainsaw-wielding madman known as Leatherface. So, what'd you think of this film, John?
Well, I'd have to say it's obviously one of my favorite slasher films. I love the gritty realism and how it slowly turns into this just deranged third act with like a family dinner. One of the things I love about it is that the character work is so good. It's very economical. So I think it's like 82 minutes. You kind of get a good sense of the main characters pretty quickly, and it doesn't like slow down at all. And it kind of reminded me a little bit of how, you know, James Cameron's usually pretty good at giving you character, understanding a character pretty quickly without having to like just, you know, stop the plot to a halt. So I love that. I've seen it like probably like 4 or 5 times, something like that. So, you know, it's one of my favorite slasher films.
Yeah, I know we were talking earlier and you described it as economical. I think you said zero fat on it. And I think that's a good way to describe it. And
they chop the fat off.
Yeah, it's a really good example.
It's a well marbled meat.
Yeah, we'll get more to the meat. Like, we'll get more to the meat later. Oh, believe me. After John watched it, he was like, "I'm kind of in the mood for a barbecue," but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's a great example of how indie films on a lower budget. What was this? 140 or something?
140,000.
Yeah, it's. The production value is there, and they use it in such a way that they kind of maximize like the effects they had, like the opening shot where the two corpses are on that that gravestone or the obelisk or whatever you want to call it, you know. And it's just like that's just such a memorable shot, and it's so haunting. And it's, you know, using your resources to the fullest. Like as you know, as you're making an indie film, you might not have all these resources, but to kind of maximize what you do have. And use those shots in a really memorable way, it goes a long way, and it can make a smaller budget film look like, you know, a bigger budget film.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the shot, and John, I'll have something to say about what you just said, but that shot specifically, I mean, it does a really, really effective job at framing the movie in a way that I think it's overlooked, which is that it is a surrealist work of art. And that's something that I feel like gets lost in some of the other movies, like especially the newer ones have kind of calcified the series as this kind of like redneck exploitation, like really sleazy, grimy, sweaty movie about backwood yokels just mutilating people, which of course it is. They're bizarre. They are.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that opening image, like the newscaster whoever is speaking over, like he refers to it as a work of art, and it's true. It's like it's reminiscent of like a Francis Bacon or like Hieronymus Bosch painting, and this sense of this aesthetic is carried over to the Sawyer's house, the interior of which has been converted into this twisted parody of domestic life, with the furniture and all the fixtures being made of human remains and. You know, the chicken, the feathers and the bones scattered all over the place. Yeah. I mean, the horror films are like at their best, a collective nightmare. And, the best ones reflect that. And especially the best Texas Chainsaw Massacre movies, because they don't necessarily make total literal sense, but it really does. There's a reason one of the most reoccurring nightmares that I had as a kid was of Leatherface just barreling down the street, just like coming towards me. Like there's, you just, it, that's, it's, and I've spoken to a lot of people who have like the same reoccurring nightmare. I mean, that's why like the ending sequence is like one of the most iconic in all of cinema. It's just such a pure exercise in just relentless dread. And when I was watching it again this morning, I was just thinking about like the way, like the reason human beings are such effective hunters, especially like going back to our nomadic days, is like, we're not the strongest, we're not the fastest, but we are relentless, and we will like hunt down a mammoth or antelope or a tiger. I don't know what we eat for days, because we have the stamina to keep going. And that's what I just think is so scary about Leatherface, is that he feels unrelenting, and he's like a force of nature that's going to keep coming for you. I didn't mean to go ramble that much, but just real quick, John, you said something earlier about how it's really economical in the way you get to know the characters. And I think I slightly disagree with you on this, because I was rewatching this, and I feel like what's interesting about this movie specifically is, with the exception of Franklin, I've watched this movie so much. I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. I get the names confused. Like I have your notes, like, okay, there's Pam, there's Jerry, there's Kirk. They're not really distinct in any kind of way. Like Kirk and Jerry, they look exactly the same. Yeah. Franklin is the only one that stands out. And I think it's interesting. And this, I noticed it this morning. One of them, Jerry, like says, Franklin, you're just as crazy as he is. but the Sawyer family all have very distinct personalities and roles. There's Drayton, who is like the relative pacifist who doesn't have the knack for killing. There's the drifter or the hitchhiker, who's obviously just like a bizarre maniac. There's Leatherface. There's Grandpa. They're the people who have like the really like economical personalities. Whereas it's true, like the kids are just pure slaughter fodder. but you are correct in that it's just like, yeah, it's just, we don't need to spend too much time like knowing their backstory. Like the remake like has them like they were in Mexico. They have like a pinata full of weed or whatever. We don't need any of that. This, like, this is just, we know exactly what this movie is. And by kind of just dropping us in to this world, it does really reflect the nightmare quality I was talking about. And sorry, I didn't mean to keep going.
So this is the second time now where you've corrected me. I feel like a very small man.
This was just a matter of just interpretation.
You're correct.
The fly was a really egregious error on your part.
That's unacceptable.
Yeah, this is my show now. Okay. I've taken over your show.
John, you brought in the writer of
there
the
can be only one
film,
Highlander,
and you're expecting to not get corrected at all.
Listen, I like pushback. Finally, I love conflict, actually. So this is great. No, you make great points. I guess I was mostly thinking of like the bad guys and Franklin as being like the main characters. I mean, Sally's, yeah, I guess you don't really know too much about her, and then the other people just nobodies. But I think that what was interesting though is just that when I say economical, I kind of also meant that they have it very easily. It's like you see two couples and Franklin, and you automatically know, oh, he's the third wheel.
He's the odd man out, yeah.
And it's the 70s, and they're not exactly that like nice about him being in a wheelchair.
Yeah. It's economical in its storytelling and in its shot selection and what it chooses to linger on and what it.
No, you weren't really wrong. I was just using that as a springboard to say that.
I love it. You know, don't back away from it.
Well, I like what you said too about it, this being a more surrealist take on it. And that's what really stood out to me, because we talked a little bit pre-show about the 2003 remake, which all three of us were in probably the ideal target market demographic for that film. We were maybe around 14 or 15. And that's kind of the one I grew up on, and the Jessica Biel one. And I don't think we got a lot of that surrealism in that one, or it wasn't, you know, the family wasn't as kind of over the top. And yeah, I don't know. That's an interesting point. I haven't seen any of the other sequels. I don't know if that aspect carried over, if that was sort of lost. But
oh, they're weird. The fourth one has Matthew McConaughey in a robot exoskeleton. It's about the Illuminati. Like, wow. they really lean into Leatherface's gender dysmorphia. Like, it's a real wild show. And the second one, I mean, the second one is just a work of beauty. I adore the second one. The second one actually has one of the, in my opinion, and people, I've said this before and people have disagreed with me, but in my opinion, one of the scariest scenes is the introduction to this character named Chop Top, who it's been a little while since I've watched it, but if memory serves, it's he's just introduced. He's got a wire hanger that he just keeps scratching on his head, and he's also like lighting it with a lighter, and he's just like being like pretty jovial. I mean, obviously menacingly, like he's a very scary looking guy, but just this like action of him just like speaking to this woman while he's lighting the tip of this wire hanger with a lighter is just, it makes my skin crawl. And that's not like, that's not a scene that's a backwoods yokel, like sadistically like torturing some teenager. Like that is just, that's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Toby Hooper. He was a genius, but no one needs me to point that out.
So what else did he do outside of this?
He followed this up with another movie that he made with Kim Henkel, who was the writer of the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Eaten Alive, which you will know from its Tarantino used a line for this movie, which is, my name is Buck and I'm here to fuck. used in Kill Bill Volume 1. He made I'm gonna be so embarrassed if I get this title wrong. Funhouse, I think title. Life Force, which is a movie where the actress is naked basically the entire time. So yes, of course I saw that as a teenager.
We're learning so much.
And of course Poltergeist, which a lot of people say Spielberg was the true director. I've heard various different interpretations from this. Some people closer to Hooper, some people closer to the Spielberg end of things. It is my opinion that Hooper is a genius, and he deserves an immense amount, if not the majority of the credit for Poltergeist. Despite Poltergeist obviously having a very Spielbergian vibe and aesthetic, it's still Hooper's the one who made that movie.
That's interesting, because I honestly thought Spielberg directed it until yesterday.
Yeah, when I was very common misconception. So you're not alone in that.
That's good. I do this podcast to feel less alone. So let's jump into a couple of the scenes. We kind of mentioned earlier this hitchhiker character who they pick up. So they just left the gravesite, and they were checking on their grandfather's grave. And this hitchhiker gets in their van, and
which, of course, like if you see a hitchhiker on the side of the road with blood on his face, of course,
Is it a birthmark?
Okay.
Well, this is a mystery. I actually know the answer, but I'm not going to say it.
Oh, Mr. Hollywood over here.
Interesting.
Because I was going to say humble brag, but this is just a full on brag. The best aspect of me working on the new Chainsaw was the studio Legendary. They, before I started writing, sent me to Texas for like a week just to hang out with Kim Henkel, the original writer.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, we just like took me to a bunch of different ranches, and like it was one of the best experiences of my life. I tricked him into watching the original movie with me, which is something that he doesn't do often.
Oh, nice.
But after a night with like him and his son and their producing partner just drinking a lot of Texas bourbon, I was able to be very convincing.
Nice.
But anyway, so yeah, I picked his brain for a few little secrets.
And that's amazing. Yeah. So you know the secret, birthmark versus blood stain. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
We will leave ourselves and the audience in suspense.
I mean, no matter what the answer is, it's not going to blow your mind. There's two options, and neither one is like especially crazy. But yeah.
Jason's like, subscribe to our Patreon to find out.
But anyway, so yeah, so van guy, blood on his face, very scary.
Yeah, so they pick him up, and you know, he's doing a lot of normal things, like takes Franklin's knife and cuts his own hand. He then takes Franklin's picture, and Franklin doesn't like it, won't pay for it, so he like burns the picture. And what I really love about that scene is the way that it plays with like social conventions, in that like you don't want to, it's very bizarre obviously, but like they don't want to like anger an unstable person, but like he keeps doing things that are like menacing and bizarre, but like,
well, this is like the episode of yours that I listened to last night, The Invitation, which is very much a movie about like the horrors of trying to maintain social convention during an increasingly awkward and potentially dangerous time.
Yeah. So where would you guys draw the line? When is that hitchhiker getting kicked out of your van? Because they gave him a long leash, I feel like. Like they're okay with the cutting the hand, the picture, the fire.
If he cut, I mean, I think I'm with them. I mean, I'm a very
Let it go.
Passive. Okay. I'm not even going to say passive aggressive. I am just I need everyone to like me at all times, including deranged hitchhikers. And so I think when he cuts my forearm, I mean, if he cuts my forearm, he's out. If he cuts the annoying guy in the group's forearm, I might be. Ah, come on, you would be
asshole. Let's see what he has to say. So $2 fair price for the picture.
I mean, in 1974 money.
Let's do a little inflation calculator.
I mean, I definitely would have paid it no matter what he said. Like, oh, $10. Have. It's like, yeah, okay.
Well, physical media. It's rarer and rarer these days.
Okay.
I do like that scene. I mean, for me, you know, it's 1974. It's pre-Reagan. But again, just rewatching it, I couldn't help but see just like the writing on the wall of late stage capitalism throughout this movie. And I do think it's, you know, I don't think this is an original thought, but I do. It is in the text, but I just do think it's really interesting that that's the scene that establishes. I mean, Franklin's talking about the slaughterhouses and the gun, the Anton Chigurh air gun. the hitchhiker is obviously very skeptical of this device, because like John Henry, all these machines are putting out these skilled laborers, putting them out of work, and then the slaughterhouse itself closes. So, you know, it's a story of people who are unable to survive in this capitalist society that we are in. So they turn to eating people, which is basically the logical endpoint of capitalist subjugation of our fellow human beings. Which is what I would say to him when I was in the van with him trying to get him not to cut me. I'd say, you're a victim of your environment. I'm cool, man.
I get it, man. I get it.
The Anton Chigurh, the air gun, it's such a cool thing. And it pops up a lot. Like I saw No Country for Old Men a long time ago, and I see it popping up in other iterations, you know, that's another thing in Banshee that I mentioned earlier, because the bad guy works in a meatpacking factory, owns the meatpacking factory. I think it's really just like a meatpacking bad guy just allows for so many interesting weapons, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, you got your meat hooks, mm-hmm. you got the air guns, you got all the knives you could ever dream of.
You got the freezers.
Yeah, the freezers. Yeah. In case the viewers were curious, $2 in 1974 would be just shy of $11 today. So are you paying $11 for that picture?
From him? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. That's fair.
What about you, Jason? Would you?
He'd be out the second the knife came out. I probably wouldn't have even picked him up, honestly. Yeah, I don't know. It's maybe movies like this are why hitchhikers have a bad rap. I don't know.
Well, I was watching The Simpsons recently, and they like pick up Bart on the road. They pick up a hitchhiker, and he looks exactly like the guy from Texas Chainsaw.
Really?
And I was just like, yeah, I guess this is like the start of people being like, yeah, I'm not picking up that guy.
Well, I think Ted Bundy was a big problem with that as well.
Oh yeah.
Is that how he did? He kind of start as a hitchhiker, and that's how he lured his
you know
victims?
What now that I'm saying it out loud, now I'm second guessing myself, but I feel like he was either picking up a lot of hitchhikers or I don't think he was a hitchhiker himself.
He was picking up, yeah,
definitely picking people up.
We'll address it on the fact check and apology show that we have to do later. I like when they kick him out too. They drive away very slowly. Like, he has time to get a lot of kicks in and smear blood on the van and everything.
Well, when he gets run over too, it's like the scene with Michael McDonald in Austin Powers. Like, he's like literally, he's just like really hanging out in front of that car for quite some time, or the truck, before he finally gets got.
Oh, it was going to be a joke I made later. Like, oh, that truck driver, he knew what he was doing. I don't know. I love that guy's chaotic energy though. Like he's like kind of an artist too. Like he's the one who's doing all like the bone designs and stuff like that. Like
mm-hmm.
Honestly, if he had his own like art studio, he wouldn't have been, you know, hurting people.
Well, the hitchhiker's the designer for the furniture?
That's the impression that we get. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he's like the grave robber, the old man. I think the guy's name is Old Man.
Or Drayden.
Like Drayden was the one who like says something later about yelling at him for grave robbing and like causing some controversies. So I assumed he was the one who's going around doing like the weird designs and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so they kick the hitchhiker out of the van, and then they arrive at one of the more useless gas stations you could possibly arrive at. A gas station that is completely out of gas, fresh out, waiting for the truck any minute now. So they just like, I guess, want him to just chill there all day and eat some of their barbecue, and that, you know, the gas truck should be there sometime that day, which that might be bullshit. I mean, do you think a truck's actually coming there? Or do they ever have gas, or are they just trying to kill people?
Well, I don't know, because he's the cook guy, Drayden. He seems to not really want to do any killing and stuff like that. So I wasn't sure if he was actually being genuine when he's like, don't go over other people's property.
Yeah, they did kind of warn him, even though it was like their family's property, like, don't go there. And, you know, he does, you know, credit where credit's due. He takes pride in his craft. You know, he makes pretty appetizing looking people sausage and roast and, you know, what have you.
Franklin was chewing down on that. Like he seemed like to be enjoying it.
Yeah, Franklin, he had like a sausage in his mouth at one point.
A very unappealing looking sausage.
Yeah. I had to like pause it and rewind, and I'm like, what is he having?
And you know, it's cold. Like it's just, it's a very, disgusting prop. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, Drayton obviously contains multitudes. He's the most complex of them all. But by the second one, he's selling chili. He's like a prize chili cook. And obviously the chili is made from long pig. Yeah, so he gets over it, I think, pretty fast. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't know. That's a good question about the gas. That place, that gas station, is now a tourist destination.
Really? Was it a functioning gas station at one point?
I think probably, yeah. Okay. I don't know if it still is. We didn't get gas there when I was there. But it's like now it's just this awesome, like, it's they sell barbecue and I didn't have any, but supposedly it was really good. it's just a bunch of horror memorabilia. Like, it's all insanely expensive, but
that's cool.
It's just a really cool, like, kind of like nerdy spot to visit.
I've driven through Texas a couple times and there are several gas stations that do look like that in, you know, 2021.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you pull in and you're a little confused what to even do. I think a lot of them might even still be cash. But yeah, that's not far off from a representation even for today. Mm-hmm. So a little off topic, just regarding barbecue made from human flesh. I read this story maybe a year or two ago where this guy had some sort of surgery that, you know, part of his flesh was being removed and he asked to keep it because he wanted to see how human flesh tasted. So I don't know if you guys heard about this, but he had some friends over and he made like human flesh tacos and they all were like, okay, we'll try it. Would you guys-
It was like his foot, right? He had like his foot
something
amputated.
Like that. It, mm-hmm. Well, would you guys taste human meat under those circumstances?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. A whole taco vegetarian. Or maybe just a taste?
Well, it depends on the taste. I'm a vegetarian, which is why I didn't have any of the barbecue at the gas station, but that's just my issues with factory farming. If it's mm-hmm. My friend's foot, yeah, why the hell not? I don't have any problem with that.
Okay, friend's foot, thumbs up. Okay,
yeah, I'd be rude not to.
I am kind of taken aback by the swiftness of those responses.
No hesitation at all.
I definitely would. If it was Jason, if it was your leg, definitely.
Well,
this brings up a good point. I guess it depends on my friend. Because there are some friends of mine that I'd definitely be insisting, like, let's make sure this is not going to be a medium rare kind of thing. Like, I need to make sure any parasite is.
Let's cook it through.
Yeah.
This guy hasn't done calf day in a while. We're not sure the kind of meat we're getting. Man.
Jeez. I mean, I can't really think about many, you know, and many of my friends that'd be like, yeah, I definitely eat some of that. But Jason, definitely.
I'm really sorry that I brought this up. So, all right.
Come on,
so,
Jason, you wouldn't take a bite out of me? Come on.
Well, last episode, I hypothetically murdered you and buried you. I don't know. I can't process all of this. Okay. So they leave the gas station with no gas and then they arrive at the old house and they're all kind of just looking around. And it, you know, it's pretty run down and hasn't been inhabited in quite some time. They kind of just leave Franklin behind, which is like a trend. Mm-hmm. He's just not having a good time.
I felt so bad for him because mm-hmm. it's like you get the vibe that he didn't want to go on this trip.
Totally.
It's so hot out. And like, he's a big guy. I'm a big guy. I'm not in a wheelchair. So I can't imagine, you know, it'd be probably even sweatier in the wheelchair. I'm just thinking like, this sucks. And they're like leaving him alone and they're all laughing, having a good time. And, you know, I feel for the guy.
Yeah. I mean, Franklin is a very interesting character in that, like, very sympathetic given all the circumstances you just described, but also they don't really try to make him super likable. Like, they really allow him to be a little repugnant. And off-putting.
Well, see, that's why I relate to him because he says certain things he shouldn't. He's like talking about the slaughterhouse mm-hmm. and like they're like he's talking about the gun versus the hitting the cattle over the head mm-hmm. and they're like, all right, move on. And I was like, yeah, no, he's going on a tangent. He doesn't mean to
let
be.
Him finish.
Yeah, like, you know, just let him go through it, you know. He seems like he hasn't been out in the house in a while or hasn't hung out with people, so, you know.
No, truly. Be nice. He is the only like real character with an actual personality that we get to see in the little glimpse that we get.
He's an interesting character. Can you shed any light on his backstory? Like, what is his condition? What put him into the wheelchair? Do we know? You might know.
I don't know.
If any of us three know, you know.
I believe there should still be some mystery in the world. So that one is not something I felt particularly pressing to answer.
Okay.
Jason, I don't know if you know this, but that movie's not real. It's not a real person. So
yeah, it's based on a true story,
what?
Though.
Yeah.
I did have a friend who legitimately thought the 16 millimeter or the Super 8 footage, whatever. Let's just harken back to Temple days of the Bolex footage at the beginning of the 2003 remake was actually real when Leatherface does indeed kill the cop.
Yeah. And that that little creepy droning, howling noise. I don't even know what that is, but that. At least from the remake, and I can see it was still in the original. That sound haunted me as a youngster.
That's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre sound. I'm going to be a bad horror fan because it's probably really that information as to what that is readily available, but I, for whatever reason, just never sought it out. I just know
what that noise is.
Yeah, what they used to make that. I'm sure that's just a piece of trivia that a lot of people know.
I thought it was, for some reason, I was thinking it was just the chainsaw hitting metal or something. I don't know. I could be wrong.
To me, it always sounded, and maybe this is just the effect that's happening while it's happening, but it sounded like the light bulb flashing those old cameras. Who knows? Probably the internet.
Okay, so while they're exploring this old house, Franklin brings up that there is an old swimming hole nearby. So Kirk and Pam, they actually leave to go find this. And as they are searching for the swimming hole, they hear a generator running at a nearby house. And they're like, oh, okay, maybe these people have some gas. So Kirk walks up to the house. Before he enters, he sees a bunch of old cars and bones, but they really need gas. So he's going to keep going. He finds a tooth on the porch,
which he gives to Pam.
Might have been a red flag.
Sweetie.
Yeah. Oh, look, I got this for you.
Might have been a red flag for some people, but. He turns this into an opportunity to give a sweet little gift and enter the house where he is promptly greeted by Leatherface, our first introduction to Leatherface. And
what an intro.
He comes out, kills him with a mallet, and he starts convulsing pretty heavily. And then he gets smashed in the head a few more times.
That stuck with me for years. I'm guessing it's because his skull was hitting into his brain, so he's twitching. Mm-hmm. And I just remember thinking that's what happens if you hit when you hit someone over the head.
Injuries horrify me. You see videos online fight videos of some guy just getting punched in the head and it doesn't seem that hard, and then their hands tense up or they start twitching. That's brain injuries are no joke, and Leatherface knows that.
If anything, this movie really does lean into the idea that we are all just big old hunks of meat and we're occasionally animated, and that can be taken away real fast and things can go haywire. Something I've always just really appreciated about this scene as just a clever use of our expectations. The movie's called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You're going in to it with the expectation that there's going to be a massacre in and around the use of a chainsaw. And then so before they get to the house, they hear the rumbling of an engine. And you're like, oh, here it is. Mm-hmm. The chainsaws are coming. But it's a generator. And so you kind of let your guard down, and then Jerry takes a mallet to the head. Or is it Kirk?
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's Kirk.
Like I said, I get them confused. I hope I don't get canceled within my community for these.
thanks, mistakes. John and Jason.
I'm making a point here. They are they are indistinguishable from each other. But
it's a good point.
Yeah.
So Pam's outside. She's getting some sun. A little too much time goes by for her liking. She decides to go into the house, where she happens upon a room full of chickens and feathers and bones, and then just a bunch of furniture made out of human remains.
Mm-hmm.
Not ideal. So
I thought it was quite artistic, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, this is where like the Ed Gein thing comes in. Like,
so that's what he did, right? He did.
Yeah, he would grave rob and make lampshades out of nipples, or belt buckles out of nipples.
While we were watching the film the other night, my wife showed me the nipple belt, and I asked her to kindly never show that to me again.
But yeah, so this is like why, based on a true story, it's the same thing as Silence of the Lambs and Psycho and just a myriad of other movies. They all take from Eddie.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So Leatherface finds her, obviously, and promptly hangs her up on a meat hook, which... And it takes like zero effort. The dude's so strong, just lifts her up and she's on a meat hook and he goes about butchering Kirk, right? Yeah.
Yeah, the chainsaw.
And this is when we first see the chainsaw and he's kind of, you know, very meticulously, you know, I guess parting the meat off.
He's being processed.
I got to ask, Chris, is this the movie that got you to be a vegetarian?
No. There was no... real thing. Chloe's a vegetarian. It was just really easy for me to.
Yeah. So I saw that it was something. I was reading something online that people were saying like that Texas Chainsaw was kind of like inspiring to them to like not eat meat. So I just thought that was kind of interesting because I watched it and I was thinking like I was. Maybe it's just COVID. I don't know. I was talking to Jason about like the barbecue joints we've been to before. And I was like mentioning something to him about like, I forget, we were somewhere and. Some barbecue place and Jason like leans over as I'm looking at the menu. He goes, "You're going to want to get the brisket."
I did have barbecue when with Kim Henkel. He took me to a barbecue spot and I'm not going to say no to that. And it was delicious. It was amazing. It's ruined awesome. Me for the rest of time.
Okay. So next we got Jerry. Jerry's hanging out with his girlfriend, Sally and Franklin. And then Jerry decides, all right, let me go look for these two characters. All right, so he goes in the house, and I just think it's so funny that, like, just the outside of that house doesn't look very, like, intimidating or scary or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I remember, I think it was the remake, the house looks very, like, weird on the outside or whatever, but, so...
It's scarier, for sure.
Yeah, but it is nice that it's kind of just, like, you know, you go up to the house, and you go in, and it doesn't seem that weird until you get to, like, the red wall with like the bones on it or whatever. So yeah, Jerry is walking around looking for everybody. He hears something knocking on the freezer, opens the freezer and Pam pops out and then turns around and Leatherface is there with his mallet again and he just pops Jerry on the head.
Makes quick work out of Jerry. When Pam popped out, that made me jump a little bit. Not gonna lie. Yeah. First time watching it.
Yeah. Like
I thought she was long gone.
As Kim pointed out to me, I don't think I'm telling any tales out of school here. You never actually see Pam die. Mm-hmm. And so in my personal little headcanon, there's definitely a Stockholm syndrome kind of situation at first, but I like to think that eventually she became the family matriarch, really cleaned up their act. Cause there's no women in the, mm-hmm. in the Sawyer household. And thus no kind of, civilizing influence. And I like to think that Pam really got, she became the mother that Leatherface never had.
I like that.
Was there maybe some sort of written pages that had to do with this situation?
I think I could say this is an idea I definitely pitched. I don't think anyone's going to be surprised to find out that that's not going to be in any new movie. No. But also like real quick, I think it's, you mentioned how the house does not seem all that intimidating, which I think is like just kind of cool in that, you know, they're at the previous house, which is definitely Sally and Franklin's old house, which definitely has the more haunted aesthetic where, you know, an astute viewer would be a little bit more primed to believe that something malevolent is going to occur within those walls. But yeah, they tricked you. They got you.
They did.
Yeah, and I always love the scene, like, after Jerry has been brained that, or is it Kirk?
Jerry, it's Jerry. Jerry. Okay. Kirk's dead.
that's when you see, like, it's one of the few times you actually, like, are just alone with Leatherface as your perspective. And just seeing it is, like, just, it's just so fucking funny. These movies are hilarious. And just he's like, oh shit, like, ah, fuck, oh god damn it, Leatherface, like, you really got yourself into it this time.
What a pickle.
That scene kind of baffled me. What is he so upset about? Like, is he out of
keep coming in?
Yeah, I think.
Yeah. No, they're literally like presenting themselves to him, and he's in this game of slaughtering humans. Like, shouldn't he be jazzed about that? Or is he just like out of freezer space and he's like, I can't do any more today?
I think like one or two, you're like, all right. Like, if two like vivacious women came up to you on the street and were just like, hey, Jason, I know you're not married. You want to have a good time? You'd be like, awesome. But then a third one, you're like, something's up.
So Leatherface has his limits. He was overwhelmed at that point.
He was cool with like two, and then.
Seriously, a third? Jesus.
Mm-hmm. He's tired. He's just chopping up the meat, and then like another one comes in.
So meanwhile, Sally and Franklin are just kind of back chilling by the van. It's dark out now. Jerry is not back. Franklin wants to leave. His vacation's ruined. His vacation was ruined a long time ago. But
I think it's also that scene is kind of cool because it makes you remember how precarious things would be when you didn't have cell phones, that like,
yeah,
you couldn't just go, oh, let me call Jerry or whatever. And it's like, you can't just leave them there in an area that there's like, you know, nobody's there. So like, how long do you wait until your friends show back up? You know, it just feels very like uncomfortable. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if they did have cell phones, you'd have to include that like perfunctory scene where they like find the cell phone somewhere else, you know, like it's mm-hmm. in just like a hand or something.
Or there's no reception.
Yeah. There's mm-hmm. no reception. So they ultimately decide to go look for Jerry, which I feel like probably that's one of the more rational decisions made in the film. Go look for mm-hmm. your friend, because they have no reason to believe that anything too malicious has happened. Maybe they just all found
the watering hole.
Yeah, maybe they all found the swimming hole and it's cool. And maybe that's why Franklin doesn't want to go. He's like, guys, I'm not swimming right now. Let's go home. But so they go, and lo and behold, they come across Leatherface. And
that him being revealed and then chainsawing Franklin was probably the most I've jumped from like a jump scare or whatever kind of moment in a movie. Because I remember that like scared the shit out of me the first time. Because when I first saw it, I assumed Franklin was in it to the end. I don't know, just because he was the main guy. And it's just like, nope.
Yeah.
You're gone.
Yeah. He's really presented as they're pulling a Hitchcock. He's presented as the lead.
So he makes quick work on Franklin.
Psycho specifically. Sorry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he chainsaws Franklin to death, which is the first actual chainsaw death we've seen. Mm-hmm. The other two or three have been mallets, and we don't know if Pam's dead. And then it's interesting. He starts chasing Sally, and this was horrifying to me. Leatherface can run with a chainsaw.
Oh, yeah.
He careens.
Like, sprints. Like, I was kind of expecting, like, the brisk walk.
He catches up to her a few times, and then she's got to, like...
He's so close so many times.
Yeah.
But he's clumsy, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's a chainsaw weigh? It's got to be... I've never held a chainsaw, if you couldn't have guessed. 15 pounds?
Yeah, 20, 30 pounds.
20, 30 pounds, yeah.
They're hefty, yeah.
Okay. Did you get to hold a chainsaw when you were doing your research?
No, like, but feel at this? The Bad Hombre, Fede Alvarez's office, they had a chainsaw that they had bought specifically for just the ability to appreciate its weight. So we would have like story meetings.
Okay.
And just be walking around. So cool.
It's heavy.
Yeah.
Okay. So Leatherface is fast, even with an extra 20 or 30 pounds. So he starts chasing Sally. Sally makes it in the house. She runs upstairs.
So she sees like the grandpa there, which I'm a little confused on how alive grandpa is, because he looks completely dead. And I think, wasn't there another corpse that was there?
The grandma's corpse is there. Yeah.
So she sees that and she's like, all right, don't want any part of that. And I guess she goes to go downstairs, and then Leatherface is cutting through his own door, which I thought was hilarious. And he's doing it in the very like the least like effective way, just making V's the whole time. And
yeah, he's a goober. He's like He's like, he's basically Kevin from The Office, just like a little bit, you know, more homicidal.
Silly goose. Mm-hmm. So he gets through and she's like, wait a minute, he's right there. So she runs back upstairs, and I thought it was pretty badass that she just jumps through a window just immediately. Like, her instincts just kick in and like, I'm going through that fucking window. And so she jumps out of there. She just starts booking it, gets to the gas station. Drayden's there, and she's like, oh, there's a guy after me. And he's like, let me get my truck. And he shows up with the, what was it, like a burlap sack and rope. Obviously, that's
not somebody who's trying to help you.
No. Yeah. He's like, oh, I'll drive you somewhere to go call for help. And
yeah, and while she's at the gas station, she originally goes there for help. That's when she sees all this meat cooking, and she's starting to kind of make that connection too. Like, mm-hmm. what is this barbecue?
Mm-hmm.
But she also hasn't really seen a bulk of the slaughtering or anything mm-hmm. yet. So, but she's starting to piece it together.
Yeah.
So they end up back at the house, right? And then that's when we first discover that the hitchhiker from earlier is part of this whole operation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's there.
And he refers to Leatherface, or implies Leatherface's brothers with the hitchhiker.
Right.
I kind of love that Drayden treats both of them as like complete like idiots. Like, it's like the Three Stooges and he's Mo mm-hmm. just
yeah.
beating the shit it's out of Curly astute. And Larry.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. I like that.
I think of like with the grandpa there, and they kind of imply
grandpa
that
Shemp.
This is amazing. We could talk about some Three Stooges. yeah, but like, so like the grandfather is like, they imply he's like known for being like one of the best killers at the slaughterhouse. And it's like the rest of these people are like, aside from Drayden, the other two are just like, just over the top fail sons that they can't be trusted for anything. Like, you leave him alone, he's going to cut through the front door, and the other one's going to steal some bodies in the graveyard.
Yeah, they're troublemakers. It's like Mike Huckabee's sons.
So then we get the climax of the movie, which is a bizarre dinner scene with Sally, Leatherface, the hitchhiker, Drayden, and Grandpa. And they all keep being like super menacing and planning to kill her, and they're like, oh, let's get Grandpa to kill her, he's the best. And I gotta say, I was pretty underwhelmed with his skill.
I love how they still think he's the best. They like carry him downstairs, this corpse looking dude,
and he's like holding the, he can't even hold the mallet for too long either. And I gotta say, they gave him way too many chances.
Yeah, there's no power behind his swing. He's really trying though.
I don't know. It kind of speaks, I think it speaks pretty well of Leatherface and how he, you know, was being pretty like nice to his grandfather.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, yeah. He's also being, I mean, this is something I never noticed till I was just watching it today, but like, they have a plate out for Sally. Like, they're yeah. feeding her. Like, she's like, they are being good hosts.
Yeah. They're misunderstood artists, really.
Truly.
Yeah. I mean, the food doesn't look bad. I mean, you guys already admitted you would eat like tacos from my
yeah,
foot.
Yeah, but I wouldn't eat that sausage that yeah. Franklin
you wouldn't
was
eat.
Eating.
You wouldn't eat the sausage disgusting. That Franklin had.
I okay. would eat Jason tacos any day.
Okay. I don't know how
serious
to respond
finale.
To that.
Anyway.
Live on the air, Johnny eats me.
I just Gardner get a bunch.
Herzog eats his shoe. John eats his co-host.
I just get a lot of like concerned texts from friends being like, "You probably shouldn't post that." Or like, it's eating has become some sort of disorder for you. You want to eat your friends now.
What if that's your actual long game for this podcast? It's not to spend time with me.
It's to butter you up.
Literally. I start picking all the restaurants we eat at. No, Jason, you can have more. Fine.
Yeah, Jason, is that organic? Just curious.
Anyway, so as they're trying to get Grandpa to kill Sally, Hitchhiker, you know, he's getting a little impatient, so he wants to kill her. she breaks free and runs out, and then both of Leatherface and the hitchhiker both start chasing her. We mentioned it earlier that the truck driver intentionally murdered the hitchhiker on purpose. So, you know, he's dead. She jumps into the back of another truck and drives away. And she's like crying, laughing. I like that mixture of emotions that they display on her. It's just like, she's terrified. She's really good. That actress is so good at like conveying.
Burns. She's fantastic. Yeah. Yeah. And the first time I spoke to Kim, I kept referring to her as Marilyn Chambers, who is an adult film star. And he very graciously pointed that out to me, and it was humiliating. But no, she's utterly fantastic.
So then the final bit we see is Leatherface dancing in like the, you know, on the road. And I just got to say, so powerful.
Yeah.
So powerful.
Yeah. Something I've always loved about this, I obviously mentioned the surrealism, and this is just kind of like a perfect example of that, because ostensibly it all takes place like during dawn, but the quality of the light during the actual, like the final like shots is so clearly dusk. And it's so like just in, so when they come out of the house, there's the, it's like the blue, like pre-dawn kind of like light, then you get the sun, and then it ends with sundown basically. And it feels like, obviously not literally, but it really gives the impression that like they've lived an entire day within this one sequence. And it's inexplicable. I don't know if I could like point to some like thematically resonant reason why that works, but it just does. It just, it again, it just makes the, it gives the entire film the feeling of a nightmare. It works and operates on a dream logic that is why I think it's so, it imbues itself like a parasite into your subconscious to mix several metaphors.
Yeah. And that the end scene all the way, the dinner scene all the way up through the ending is just like, it feels so surreal. And that's, I feel like, an element that was really missing from the 2003 remake. When I, you know, from what I remember as a youngster watching that, I never really got, you know, that next level kind of bizarre surrealism from that. But yeah, you're right. It does. It looks like dusk, that golden era, like they love to talk about in film school. And just like the chainsaw flailing. And I was looking online last night, the poster for your new film, that's kind of hidden in there, right? There's
that had to be pointed out to me. I did not
really
notice that. Yeah.
Should have said it was your idea.
No, they're very smart over in that marketing department.
So what is the new one going to be called?
Right now, I think I'm okay just saying that it's called the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's going to change, but yeah, that's what it's called right now.
Yeah, I think I don't have the poster up in front of me, but I don't know if it actually committed to a title or not. You might know better.
I think it just said Texas Chainsaw, but I think that was the website that they had it on.
Yeah, well, yeah. Texas Chainsaw is the name of the, not the penultimate one, or yeah, I guess the penultimate one currently, the one that came out in, I forget, 2011, 2012, 2013, one of them.
Yeah, you're right. There's no really, there's no real title on it. So let's just wrap up the other kind of housekeeping things we have here. You know, as far as how this relates to other slasher films. So far we've watched Peeping Tom and Psycho in our slasher series. So this one kind of ups the ante a little bit, you know.
Definitely.
Peeping Tom, we had the very cool but limiting tripod knife weapon. Psycho, traditional butcher's knife, classic. Now we got mallets and chainsaws. So how are you guys seeing this film as kind of a progression of this slasher genre?
Well, it's interesting because, like, I guess up to this point, like, all of these movies that we've talked about have had issues with, like, censors or polite society having a problem with the violence that's being displayed. And this one was interesting. I guess Tobe Hooper actually was trying to go for a PG rating with this movie, which is kind of funny.
Interesting.
Because you do see blood, but it's actually not that, like,
there's not a lot of it. Yeah. I mean, you get it from the hitchhiker. I mean, this is like one of those classic examples that people point to all the time of a movie that does not really, it's not particularly explicit, but because, you know, your mind fills in all the details. So like, for example, like Pam going up on the hook, there's like blood on the wall behind her. Maybe, I think it's blood, but it's not, I don't think it's fresh. Like you just see her kind of being suspended in the air, making a pained face, but it doesn't get any more explicit than that in terms of gore. Obviously, Kirk flailing around on the ground making, well, I guess Leatherface is probably the one making the squealing noises. Never been able to particularly point to where that's coming from, which is kind of why I love it. I do love the idea of him just upon taking the mallet to the forehead just goes completely animalistic.
So all of these aspects in consideration, Leatherface, John, would you survive this killer?
No. Okay, here's why. Sally, she's in good shape.
Yeah,
she's fit. She's running top speed, and he's catching up to her multiple times, but he's clumsy, like we said earlier. I'm clumsy, and I'm not in shape. I'm getting like 2-3 minutes into that run, he's catching up to me, and I'm begging him to kill me. I'm like, just do it, please. I'm so exhausted. Please make me into delicious barbecue. Thank you.
I'm gonna die as I lived.
Yeah.
That was my my thought process exactly when I saw how fast he was with the chainsaw, and now knowing how much they weigh, no, I'm done. I wouldn't.
Yeah, I don't think I'm telling any tales out of school when I say that. Yeah, I am. I'm meat. I am a meal.
We're all dead. He's 3 for 3. And yeah, he's pretty upset that he now has
he's
all
got
these
a pretty
bodies
good track
to
record.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think this is the first time everyone's agreed that like, no, we're not surviving this.
More formidable foes have gone up against Leatherface and lost than I. Yep. So yeah.
All right. So before we wrap this up, we just wanted to have a post-review discussion with Chris a little bit. You know, as we mentioned previously, and as you picked up on when we were talking through the film, Chris is the writer for the new Texas Chainsaw movie, which is scheduled for release this year. Is that still on track?
Who knows? I mean, hopefully, but as we all know, it's because all the movies that were supposed to get released last year are now, a lot of them are, it's a very packed year. So
everything's getting pushed. Yeah.
We shall see. No set release date has been announced or even discussed as far as I know.
So to backtrack a little bit, like we mentioned earlier, Chris and I, we lived out in LA after we graduated for a few months doing internships, and then Chris stayed out there. So what did you end up doing for a job? You worked with, you reviewed scripts, right?
I was very fortunate in that our friend Valerie, she had gotten a job at a production company, and she had gotten me an interview there to be an assistant. And it was a small production company called Sobini Films. And I got the job, and I just stayed put for like seven years while I was there. I wanted to be a writer, and that provided a good paycheck. I mean, not a good paycheck. It provided a paycheck. And I was in the film world. And yeah, I a part of the job as an assistant at a production company is your busy work is typically you are constantly reading screenplays and writing what's called coverage for them, which is basically like a little book report that you do so your boss can pretend that they had read the script. And I don't think it's a surprise to learn that if you are doing that, I mean, it's just a fantastic education as to how to be a writer if you are just reading and reviewing scripts all day in between, you know, getting coffee and printing and scheduling, all that kind of grunt work. You read mostly terrible screenplays, which is, it can get a little arduous, obviously, but it's also, it's just a fantastic education as to what to avoid. You learn a lot from the mistakes that other people have made. And then every once in a while, you read something amazing. And that is also educational in that you can see what could be done with the form. And so basically, I was just clocking in 10 to 11 hour days every day there while also simultaneously writing my own stuff And yeah, eventually I think I got good at it enough that I was able to make a living at it.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like, you know, you say you review a lot of bad scripts and then some good scripts. I feel like you probably were able to find inspiration in each, like reading the bad ones. You're like, oh no, I would have done it this way. And then that gets the wheels turning. Mm-hmm. And then a good one, you're like, oh, that's so clever. So, you know,
certainly,
I guess,
yeah.
What, to backtrack a little bit, when did you know you wanted to focus on screenwriting? Cause that was an area where you were obviously strong when we were all at Temple. So yeah. At that point, did you know you wanted to pursue writing, or were you kind of leaving it open?
Going into film school, I wanted to be Paul Thomas Anderson, auteur, genius, beloved by everyone. I wanted to do everything. And then I got to film school and quickly learned that I am not good and sometimes hate a lot of the filmmaking process. And the actual making of the movies was not something I necessarily excelled at. But what I did really enjoy was just the ability, when I had the most control, was when I could just go off to either, I don't know, my room, my dorm room, or the tech lab and just create a story without the limitations of like knowing, like, I don't know how to work. Just renting a camera from the equipment office is a Kafka-esque nightmare. Like, I don't know how I'm supposed to do that while also convincing 10 to 20 of my peers who also have their own homework to do and projects of their own to be in my stupid little movie. So it was that's where I started focusing on screenwriting. I was disillusioned. I quickly learned that I'm just a bad director and a terrible producer.
So I've always admired your writing. We got to read a lot of each other's work coming through school. And, you know, I've been working as a video editor for the past 8 years, and I'm still a firm believer in the notion that a film or, you know, a short or a commercial is really only as good as the script. You need the director to kind of bring that vision to life. But, you know, I've seen a lot of areas where scripts have been undervalued. And I just think it's, you know, it's an invaluable skill to have. And at least, even if you're not a writer yourself, to just like be able to recognize a good script. So, Chris, you've had a lot of success, even with your previous scripts. You've had a couple that were on the Blacklist, and that might sound bad to our listeners, but the Blacklist in Hollywood, it's actually a list of the most liked unproduced screenplays of the year as selected by film executives. And, you know, that the list in the past, I believe it started around 2005, it has included, you know, such Oscar winning films as Juno, The King's Speech, Argo, Slumdog Millionaire, just to name a few. Just looking over that list, you kind of wonder how some of them even remained unproduced, just the quality of the films. And I was lucky enough a couple of years ago, you sent me a copy of your film, The Wretched Emily Derringer. And I loved it. I read it in one night, stayed up till like 3 o'clock reading it. I was just hooked and it was great. That's about a 13-year-old serial killer. The Misfit Butcher, I believe she goes by, and it's a serial killer / coming of age tale, and I loved it. And I actually forced my wife to read it the next day, and she loved it. And I remember remarking, if nobody ever makes it, I'll direct it as my debut feature film. So the offer's still on the table. If that happens. Right.
I think I can say there might be some good news with that one being announced semi soon. We'll see. It's awesome. Been through the ringer, but there's a very talented director attached and some.
So suck it, Jason.
No editor though. There's no editor. And also, as having seen like the early cuts of Cobweb and Chainsaw, I can really attest to the idea that the editor is the real hero of the process. But that's very nice. The Blacklist is a thing where, you know, when you're starting out, it seems like an achievable goal, but it's also just like a really like lofty one. Like that is like every writer I know like wants to be on the Blacklist when they're starting out. Because it's also writing is I still like being on it because writing is a very solitary job, and it is the film industry is a weird one where you are often not allowed to actually speak about what you're doing. You can spend years out of your life working on a project, but you're not allowed to tell anyone about it.
That would kill me. That would kill me. I send Jason like and other people like various cuts of the podcast, like, does this work for you? Whatever. Mm-hmm. And everyone's like, leave me the fuck alone. So
so there's that, and then there's also the idea that like you know, most people, I think almost all of my screenplays are pretty much available online for anyone who wants to Google them, but for the most part, it's not a thing that people read. Like, you they're not necessarily meant to be read. They're blueprints for movies. So right. You don't, the pool of people who actually read screenplays is pretty small. And so something like The Blacklist is nice, just as like a little bit of recognition for something that you would do that, or something that you've done that there's a high likelihood that no one would ever even be aware of it existing.
Yeah, well, that's great news for Emily Derringer. I did notice when I was going through the previous films that even some from the 2005 list were being produced in 2019. So, you know, the scripts can hang in limbo for a while.
Yeah, movies. Yeah, there's movies never really dead. I think like TV, like things die all the time. Like basically, if you filmed the pilot and it doesn't go, like you're done. But TV, there's a lot of kind of resurrection, you know, Phoenix is rising from the ashes stories. So
Cobweb is another film that's in production. That's the one starring Anthony Starr that we discussed earlier. So what's the progress on that one? Is that one pretty close?
Cobweb is, it's in post-production. It's, I think I can say I'm very excited about it. I think it's going to be a really cool, special movie. And everyone who's in it is, you know, absolutely amazing. So,
awesome.
Same thing. I don't know when it's going to come out, but it is, I know I'm biased, but I think it's pretty great.
Well, I'm excited for that one. So let's pivot a little bit and, focus on the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre film, since that was the main subject of the episode. So I guess walk us through that process. How did you get that gig? You know, kind of, I guess for somebody who doesn't know this process real quick, like, you know, what is the process of getting a screenplay picked up?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to be a little bit vague because I'm not sure how much detail I can go into, but basically that is something called an open writing assignment. And so when you are a screenwriter, you either you can write an original script and try to sell it, or write an original script and try to get it made yourself. But most of the work comes from open writing assignments, which is, you have a production company or a studio or both. And they have the rights to some property, or they have an idea. In this case, they have the rights to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It's being produced by Fede Alvarez, the writer director of Don't Breathe and the Evil Dead remake, as kind of the one shepherding the project. And I believe they met with a bunch of writers, and I went in with an idea that I thought was cool, and fortunately they seemed to like it, and so they hired me.
It's like a job interview basically. Yes. Like how much of the script, or how much when you went into this pitch or this interview, how much was prepared at that point?
It was very loose, and it gets more specific, and almost none of it actually remained through the finished project. But yeah, I mean, the real downside of being a screenwriter, it's mostly phenomenal, but it is kind of annoying how basically how often you have to create an entire movie just to get an interview for a job. Sometimes it works out though. And when it does, it makes everything else worth it. And also it's just good practice. Like, I mean, I like what I spend most of my time doing anyway. And as I always have, is just kind of dreaming up little stories. So the idea that I might, you know, get to make one, is pretty cool. And a
absolutely.
Good,
so did your managers, kind of arrange this for you? Like when you interviewed or when you pitched it, were they familiar with your work? Had they read your work prior? Or
yeah, they were familiar with Emily Derringer and Cobweb. And yes, my managers arranged it. And to my manager's credit, he told me, you know what, you're not going to get the job. They're not going to hire you. So what you should do is just don't worry about it. and just come up with like the craziest kind of version of this movie you can, and at least they'll remember you next time. And it was good advice because that's what I did. And they did like it.
That's so awesome.
Yeah, worked out.
Well, I'm glad it worked out. I've always been a fan of your writing, and you know, I know we don't see each other much anymore, but I always have, you know, fond memories of hanging out with you.
And I'll be in Lancaster.
Yeah. Come visit sometime. And you know, you're a very easy guy to root for. And I know John and I are both really thrilled with your success and just happy that you took the time to do this for us. So
my pleasure, guys.
Thank you so much for your time. It was great catching up with you, and you know, it was great talking to you.
All right, guys. I'll see you on the correction episode.
All right. I'll see you.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, that does it for this week's episode. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. And next week, we will be reviewing Black Christmas. Until then, stab you later.
The Fly was a really egregious error on your part.
That's unacceptable.
Yeah, this is my show now. Okay. I've taken over your show.